You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
Without the ones like you who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you. With professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Telling you, bro, what's been happening, bro?
Not too much.
Still hitting more Peggy O's.
Hi, my name is Shane Terrio, and you are listening to The Riff Raff. Music, stories, and insights from the front line. Riff Raff. My guest today is Mr. John Schofield, or Sco as he is known among contemporaries. You know, John really needs no introduction, though. He's one of the most recognizable voices in modern jazz guitar. He's played with everyone from Chet Baker to George Duke to Miles Davis to Herbie Hancock. The list goes on and on. He's one of my faves for sure. I first met John in Europe backstage at a jazz festival, I don't know, 5 years ago, but we didn't really get to be friends until I moved to New York a year or two ago, and we found out we were neighbors. So we get together and play every so often when we're both in town, as you can hear in the background. I can honestly say that he's one of the nicest guys you'll ever meet, and he actually gave me one of his Sco signature model guitars for my birthday. It's such an amazing guitar. So given the chance to interview John, I just asked him questions that things I wanted to know when I was a kid reading magazines and things that I always wondered about. I hope you enjoy.
Well, thanks, John, for coming over, man, to the house.
Got it, Shane. Yeah. Wow. Get to hang with Shane. This is happening.
Yeah, I just, you know, we can talk about whatever, man.
We're lucky we get to play guitar all day, and except for when we don't.
What are you up to right now? You just finished your, I know you finished that last record. It's great.
Well, yeah, with the record that came out, whatever it's called. Past Present. Yeah, with on tour a lot with that band, you know, with Joe Lovano and Bill Stewart and Ben Street on bass. And we've been playing a lot, and we will do more of that this year.
Yeah, that's a great band.
And in the summer, I'm getting ready to do this project with Brad Meldow on electric keyboards with drummer Mark Juliana.
Yeah.
And then I'm playing guitar and bass.
Started out as a double neck.
I tried the double neck. As of right now, I'm not going to use the double neck because I got a stand for the bass. So I can play guitar and then run over to the bass and just start playing that. It's basically to play bass behind Meldow's solos.
Oh,
because,
I see.
Because yeah. Brad is like doing a you know, a mini Moog bass kind of thing and playing piano and Rhodes and synth. And he does all that. And then he wants to when he takes improvised solos, it's nice to have a bass player behind him, you know. So I'm going to do that.
Are you going to put the guitar on the stand and walk over?
Yeah.
Or the bass on the stand?
The bass is on a stand, and I kind of just go over. Right now, we've only rehearsed twice, so I don't know, but right now, I kind of just walk over to the stand and play, and actually leave my guitar on where it is and just play the bass out in front of me. It didn't feel that bad. Or you can put the guitar down on your side like you're Bruce Springsteen or some rock star where you put your guitar down like that. and just stand there playing the bass.
I like to stand. It's like the cat from Air Supply. He used to have his 12-string ovation.
Right, yeah. Bands used to do that, right? Yeah. Yes did some stuff like that.
Yeah. I remember going over and playing that that other double neck you had. That was
pretty funny that day. I bought two double necks. The first one I bought was like $300, and it was amazing that they had even made this somewhere. I don't know. It was rough. And then I bought a nice vintage Ibanez, but I think I'm going to just play these two. You know, use my regular guitar and then walk over to a bass on a stand. That seems to be the answer.
I'm sure Susan's happy about this, not having to ship a double neck. You know, fly
right.
a double.
Yeah, neck. Double neck is huge.
Man. Yeah, man. I don't know how you would even. It's not like you rent it anywhere either.
No, you can't. They don't have them that are guitar and bass.
SIR doesn't have them.
No, they might have one that's 12 and 6, but not 4 and 6, you know? And then I'm doing this record of country tunes that I'm getting ready for. We're going in the studio April 1st, and we're going to do country tunes and jazz them up, you know? Mm-hmm. Turn them into bebop, on some of them anyway.
That's great, man. What's the name of the tune you played at Birdland? You told me this already.
Oh,
that was great.
Just a Girl I Used to Know.
Yeah, that was beautiful, man.
Yeah.
So it's going to be a record.
Cowboy
You're going to do that one, too?
Yeah, I want to do that one, a bunch of them. And it's that same rhythm section plus, which was Steve Swallow and Bill Stewart, and Larry Golding's on keyboards.
Nice. Great band.
Yeah, no vocals, none of that. It's going to be a jazz record, you know, with... but, you know, you can play those country tunes... it's kind of like blues or something. That when the changes are real simple, you can stretch out on them, I think.
Yeah.
And, well, we'll see. It's an experiment. You know?
It's a good, harmonically, it's a good foundation to improvise on.
Yeah, because there's not a whole lot of changes, actually, you know. And I figure we can swing them, some of them, and then just play the kind of, like the one I was playing for you before, Mama Tried.
Yeah.
It's like a jazz, an old standard or something when you kind of make the changes.
Could you play a couple, just give me a little sneak peek.
I mean, the original is, you know. But it's also.
Yeah. You're putting all the 2/5s in there with the.
Yeah. And then you can just blow on that like a jazz tune. Like that.
Yeah,
and so
really nice.
We're going to try doing some stuff like that.
Yeah, I'm sure it'll be amazing. That's great. Yeah, that's really hip. A lot of those country tunes, they're just 1/4, 1/5 with an occasional 2.
Yeah.
You know, things like that.
3 chords and the truth.
Yeah. That's all you need. When you play a lot, you know, I know like part of your sound is a lot of the open strings inside the. Is that something you must have worked on it at some point?
Oh, yeah. You know, I mean.
Or did it just sort of happen on its own and you just sort of.
Well, I heard other people doing it too. I mean, Jim Hall in jazz used to use that, and then Bill Frisell has really developed that. And it's something also that comes from rock, you know. I mean, I don't think Barney Kessel and those older guys hardly played any open strings because they were trying to sound as un-guitar.
Yeah, they
didn't play those chords. You know, they wanted to sound like 1950s jazz, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But there are a lot of possibilities for voicings, especially when you think about getting close voicings. You know, where the notes are closer together. You can't play those inversions on the guitar, you know, like...
Sure.
Like D. Like the first major 7 I played was... Like that.
So you get the B
it
in
only,
there, too.
It, with the open B. That only works in that one key, right?
Oh, yeah. Right.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's kind of hard to... Yeah, I mean, well, that's this. Yeah, you actually can play it, but then you can stick the open E on there too. So I mean, it just gives you some nice kind of open, closed position things. You know, I mean,
like a B major.
I mean,
oh yeah,
that right there, A minor 11.
I've heard you open do this B. one, I think, too. The C sharp 7 with the sharp 9 on top.
Yeah. That's probably the first one I learned, Taxman.
Yeah, that's Taxman. That's right. That's what that is.
Yeah, I learned Taxman as a kid, and I knew it had to be in the key of C sharp, you know.
Or the rock one is this one.
Oh, that's a good one, yes.
Violets and those kind of bands, you know, they all.
Yeah, they know about that, too, yeah. You play this one in C sharp. I know you do, man.
I may have played that. I've never really. Sounds like Josie.
Josie? Yeah, you're right. The beginning
I've never
of
played
Josie.
That voice.
It's nice sharp. That's like it's taking that and going a step further, putting the 13.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
You know, you know what's weird is I'm doing all these country tunes, and they sound good in D, man. You know, D just, you know, there's a bunch of them. You know, these tunes are like the other ones, you know. What's really weird is we're gonna, you know, I know you know this.
Wildwood Flower.
Yeah.
Are you gonna do that? Oh, cool.
It's a weird ass form, yeah. Right? So I was thinking, do 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 do. It's like a 5-bar phrase. Do 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 do. 3-4, and then it's 4 bars. Do 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 do. And if you just keep that as a bass line, then you go, you know. Don't play the chords, but just play. Same time.
Yeah, that's funny. I wanted to ask you about this too. It's a funny story. This is a long time ago. obviously I didn't know you then, but there was a clinic I went to once, and you were playing Protocol. And somebody asked you, you weren't playing, but somebody asked you the question. He said, how do you play over, you know, Protocol when it's, you know, there's no key center. Like, what are you thinking about when you play it? And you said, well, can you play the riff? And the guy said, yeah. And he go, okay, well, tell me when I hit a wrong note. And he started playing over it. And It was just like, you know, it was a big lesson in phrasing and, you know, the way you build tension in the release and, you know.
Well, you know, moving the stuff around and not just playing in one key. But it's not like, I don't know, you just get good at being free. And this stuff, I did it in kind of fusion contexts in the 70s. And to people, it sounded somewhat new, I guess. But it really came from jazz and from the 60s jazz musicians that got really great at that. When Coltrane came in and they started to play over vamps, you know? And it really started with Miles with Counted Blue, you know, where they would play in one key, you know?
But those are more modal vamps you're talking
those
about.
And
Protocol is
but
I don't know if
Protocol
I'm playing
is,
right, but...
Yeah, it's over that.
Is that right?
Yeah, but see, I think of that as all G.
Well, how would you play over that?
I don't think of the chain. I don't think of playing.
G anything?
Yeah, but I wouldn't play in... I would either play in G or play my shit where I move it around, you know? You know? But I'm moving stuff around, and I've developed a style and a way to do that from listening really to my idols in jazz, you know, from all the great guys in the 60s that were influenced by free jazz, you know, but they would keep playing on grooves and stuff, and Herbie Hancock and Wayne Shorter and Miles Davis and John Coltrane and McCoy Tyner and, you know, and all these great players. Then the guys that were my age, the Brecker brothers, you know, the way they played, and Joe Lovano, my buddy, you know, not just guitar players, hardly any guitar players, mostly other instruments. Mm.
Yeah, that's interesting. I hear some, there's so many signature things you do that aren't, they're not repetitive licks that you rely on all the time, but they're still signature, you know?
So, yeah, well, I got my licks, yeah.
Well, I don't mean they're licks that you rely on all the time. I just mean they're signature things.
Well,
like
you
Kirby
know what? I mean,
signature things that you hear.
They are definitely licks that I rely on. But the way I see that whole thing about licks is, if you're playing in the moment and you actually hear it, it's okay. Mm-hmm. It's another thing when your fingers do the walking and you're not actually... hearing it. You're just going on like kind of finger muscle memory. Something.
No, I didn't mean to imply that it's, you know, but like Schofield cliches you play. No, they're signature. Like you have a signature sound. And yeah, I don't know how you do it because I always play a lot of the same shit over.
Well, I do most too. Guitar players Everything too. I just played, I played before, that's for sure, when we were just playing.
Yeah. But you know, like when I heard you at Birdland, the sense of melody is there. You know, a lot of guys don't have that.
Well, I like that, and I think that's the, you know, there's the player disease, the jazz disease, the of playing too many notes, which we all kind of have, because in order to get any kind of, you know, style and blowing and soloing and all that, you know, you're going to try and play fast and learn a bunch of stuff. And sometimes it all comes out and you're not able to sound good. And in order to sound good, you have to pace that stuff with melody, I think. Because melody is the real key to music. It's the whole thing.
Yeah.
And in this, all
That's
this,
true, very
you know,
true.
The rhythm has so much to do with the music that we like, right?
Sure.
So in order to generate an exciting rhythm, you're going to end up playing a bunch of notes and stuff to, you know, like a... to get that thing happening, that jazz thing, but you got to mix it up with some melody in order to, before it, so it doesn't just sound like complete exercises or
guitardom.
Just, or, yeah, guitar, man, and also kind of masturbatory. Yeah.
You know, one thing I have to ask you about is like this other signature thing you do, where it's like I'm this is a bad impression of it, but you know, you're playing something. And you go that.
Yeah, you got it down.
I don't know. I've seen you do it before.
I do it all the time.
Where did that come from? Was it just an accident?
I don't know. I just kept making that mistake, and then I liked it. It, you know, it's supposed to sound like an R&B singer. You know.
Really, an R&B singer?
Oh, you know.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
I don't know. You know, it's just it's got that warble.
Yeah, that's
it.
Very cool.
That's...
I can't do it.
Yeah, that's good. Yeah, you got it.
I mean, if anybody else did it, they would be like, "Oh man, you're just copying Sko's thing."
I guess that, but it's your thing. That's the one original thing that I. I guess I haven't heard anybody else.
Well, like it's the only thing, but it's definitely the most identifiable.
That's
first got to New York, like you're from around this area, right? And then
I grew up in the suburbs of New York, in Connecticut, 50 miles from New York City.
Mm-hmm. And then when you got out of Berkeley, you went straight to New York?
Yeah, I went to Berkeley for 2 years. Then I lived in Boston for a year, just playing around up there. And then, but I had, you know, the desire to move to New York, so I was aiming for that. And was starting to make some gigs in New York with some jazz people, you know, little gigs. Just I would say, okay, you know, pays $50, I'll be there. You know, it, even like kind of in the burbs around New York, in New Jersey. I remember playing in Lakewood, New Jersey, driving down. You know, and it was, but it was to play with some of the New York guys, you know, that were my age and so I was starting to do that, and then I was able to move down in January of 1975.
So when did you ever have to have any sort of, you know, extra day gig or whatever to keep afloat, or where you had enough?
You know,
gigs
I'm lucky
on?
That way. I was doing. Well, first of all, I didn't have much money, mm-hmm. but I just would do any gig I could. and which meant, you know, Holiday Inn bands or wedding bands, and also giving guitar lessons, mm-hmm. and just any of that stuff to just to stay afloat. And I didn't have to do day gigs.
That's great.
I think it's different for musicians nowadays. Yeah, it's a lot different. You know, a lot of really good players end up having to do temp gigs and drive taxis and all that.
I know we've talked about all this before, but, you know, me being from New Orleans and stuff and talking to Mac and Dr. John, you know, Mac, and for the people that don't know, Ricky Sebastian, they've all told me stories about back in the day, you know, and I think Mac and Charlie Neville had a loft that was like 400, I remember it was like $250 a month or something.
Wow.
They just keep
yeah.
it. But Mac said that you were in his band with Ricky, because Ricky was like trying to make ends meet in New York when he first got there, and he would just play with Mac for extra money, and I guess it was you and Jocko got wind of it. Were you in the band the same time as Jocko?
Like, no, I never played any gigs when Jocko played with Mac. And Ricky played drums, another drummer too, I forget. But I didn't play that many gigs with Mac. You know, he called me. He was always getting different bands and stuff. Yeah. But it was the, you know, the really good horn players, Lou Marini and Ronnie Cuber, Charlie Miller, and
Wow, yeah. Mac said that, he said he liked Jocko, but what did he tell me? He said, anytime in my life at that point when shit went wrong, I looked to my right and Jocko was right there.
Yeah. Well, Jocko, when I think the period he's talking about, when Jocko was living in New York and he would make gigs with people that he liked sometimes, you know, Jocko was already a superstar, you know, and but he was really in bad shape. Because of drugs and that sort of stuff. And, yeah.
So that would have been like early 80s?
Yeah, early 80s, yeah.
It's a word of mouth period, probably.
Yeah, he'd already done the word of mouth, and that had been real successful, but he was just on this huge downward spiral, almost like a street person, you know?
That's when you guys did the DCI video around that
yeah,
time.
Yeah, right, yeah. But I had met him, you know, in 1976, I had heard about him from Pat Metheny, because I knew Pat even before Pat was famous up in Boston. We were both there on the jazz scene, and Pat told me about Jocko and said, there's this guy, he's the most unbelievable bass player I ever played with, and he's like our age, John, but you wouldn't believe how good he is. Only problem is, he's kind of an asshole. And, you know, Jocko was incredible, man. When I heard that first record that he made and first stuff he was doing, he actually blew my mind more than I think anybody I ever met, almost. Never met anybody my age who was so, such a great, I mean, he had his own sound. He changed the instrument, and he could play funky and he could play jazz. He had this incredible sound on the instrument.
That first record is amazing.
I mean, yeah, it was amazing.
It was unbelievable to hear that. Even now, I listened to it, you know, a month or so ago. I saw that movie and I listened to the whole record.
I still gotta watch that movie.
You'll like it.
Thank you for lending it to me. I'm hesitant to watch it because it was such a sad demise. Yeah. It was really bad.
But you know, they don't really harp on that as much. Of course, it's in there, but it's mostly positive stuff as much as you could be. You know, the one thing about the movie I thought was interesting is that there's no mention of Pat Metheny, and
I think Pat doesn't want to be involved in it. It's really weird because he was the guy who was the closest to Jocko.
Yeah, right.
You know, because they made Broadside's Life, Pat's first record, after he had, you know, Pat had this whole history with Jocko before that in Miami as young musicians.
Yeah, I figured as much, but you know.
Yeah, I'm not sure what the story is. Yeah.
When you play, I mean, you play a whole variety of formats instrumentally, like upright bass sometimes or Steve Swallow, and you know, I'm sure you must change your approach somewhat, but when you play with an upright, I know I asked you about this once, Are there things you changed in your approach? I mean, I guess voicing-wise, you might comp more when it's upright.
I don't know. You know, I mean, you mean without keyboards, like when you're
playing? Yeah, without keyboards, or even if you had, you know, maybe keyboards with an upright, is there something you would do different, or maybe not?
Not really. I mean, I try to blend with the band, you know. I mean, it depends on what kind of music you're playing, whether I prefer upright or electric. But I don't think, I think I'm just used to doing a chain. I've played with upright my whole life with a lot of, you know, classic jazz type people like my, you know, that I ended up playing with. So I'm just used to it.
Yeah.
And maybe there's stuff that I do with the subconscious. I don't know. Yeah. But I'll tell you this much, electric instruments really work well together. Electric bass and electric guitar, electric keyboards, they just, you know, as soon as you bring an acoustic element in there, it makes it a little more difficult. And I've really worked on trying to get electric guitar to work with upright bass and saxophone. That's part of it's just playing on, and piano, that's, you know, part of it's just playing softer and trying to play in their space, you know, rather than having just this electric space over on the other side, you know.
Mm-hmm. Well, Steve Swallow sort of got his own thing going on with
He's different from anybody.
Yeah, yeah. I always liked that first, the first couple of records that you probably, I don't even know if they were intended to be records, the ones in Germany.
Yeah, they were actually intended to be records.
I didn't know if it was just a gig and that.
No, they, the recording company Endra came and recorded those. Yeah,
yeah. That's a great tone. You said that's just a polytone, just cranked.
That's
up,
my right? Polytone. That was back when I could actually bring it to Europe. I brought it on the plane. Wow.
And your 335.
That's my 335. Yeah. It might have been the Ibanez by that point. That was around the same time I first got the Ibanez.
Now that Ibanez you have now, that's your main.
Well, they're
you have
both
two
main.
Of them, right?
Don't I got two of them. One's from 1982 or 81, and this one's from 86.
Okay.
But
and that one has the coil tap.
This one does not have the coil tap.
Oh, what's that little toggle?
Oh, it does, but it's not hooked up.
Oh.
Sorry.
It's a producer switch.
Both of mine, yeah, right. Sucks, switch. Both of my guitars had the coil tap, but I never used it. Mm. And they've been disconnected. But this one has new pickups. These are, what are they called? They're from Memphis. Voodoo pickups.
Oh.
And my guitar tech, Norio in New York City, recommended those. The other Ibanez I have has the original pickups in it.
59 Alnico, whatever they
whatever are. Their pickups that they were making in 1981.
So did Ibanez just approach you and
yeah,
you just say,
then,
hey, you know, we have this guitar?
I was on tour in Europe with Tara Masahino, and I'm sorry, in Japan with Tara Masahino. And it was right before I joined Miles Davis's group, so it was 81. So, yeah, that first guitar is 81. And they were trying to get American artists to play their guitars. At that point, they weren't as famous as they are now. And they gave me a guitar. And I liked it.
You just bonded with it.
Well, I had been playing my 335, and I was in Japan. My 335, at that point, I didn't know how to do truss rod adjustments on my guitars. So the guitar was really in bad shape. It needed a real adjustment, and here I was in Japan, I didn't know anybody, and they gave me this guitar at the beginning of the tour. They didn't say use it, they just gave it to me, and I took it out of the case and started playing it. It felt great and it sounded good, and it was similar to the 335, so it wasn't that far of a stretch. And I just never went back to the 335. The Ibanez felt good to me. But I still like my old 335. It's sitting home, forlorn, abandoned in its case.
I played it.
You played it, right?
Yeah, when I was there in October. It's a beautiful guitar. I don't know. You want to play something? You want to play...
What do you want to play, man?
Let's play... what did we play last time? Oh, Hey Joe, you want to play
that?
Yeah. Those are cool changes to play over, man. They're
it's sort of like...
Like you're talking about the country... the country music thing, you know, just fundamentals, and then...
Yeah, Hey Joe has got some nice changes, right?
What key are you playing in? I thought you were just doing the...
Oh, I'm in the wrong key. It's funky.
When you, I mean, you've probably inspired a whole, all the jazzers to buy a distortion pedal, you know, the Rat. And Well, I don't know if, even know if you use a rat anymore, but what? How did that get? How did you start that? Like, did you just? Was it a rental amp that sounded really shitty, and you wanted to?
Yeah, you know, I had the rat, and yeah, if I, you know, for a while, I had this. Yeah, I had amps that broke up nice. I had an old Fender Tremolux in the early 70s that then it kind of died or something. And then I remember various amps. And then I had an Ampeg amp, too, that I really liked. It was Herb Buschler, the bass player's wife's amp. And I had it for like 2 years because he wasn't using it. And then he asked for it back. It was his amp, actually. It was in the basement of a club, Sweet Basil's, and I took it home. And I said, man, can I use this amp? He said, sure. Then 2 years later, his wife wanted to play her Fender piano through it, so I had to give it back. And then I was playing gigs with twins and stuff, and it just didn't sound good. And I had this rat pedal, so I just started using that, and that seemed to warm it up. Oh. And I just stayed with it for years. Although, for the last 15 years or so, I've been playing through Voxes, and those distort naturally in a nice way. So I haven't used the rat AC-30s, as much, right? The AC-30. Yeah.
Well, in your record, your new record, you just plug straight into the Deluxe, right?
I have an old Deluxe from 64, and I just played straight through
nice,
it, and I like the tone on that.
You could hear it. It was nice. You could hear that power tube crunch, too, on it. There's one tune where you did some bend like this, and you could just hear the tubes crunch.
You can hear them going. Really nice. Yeah. It's nothing like it, you know.
You like Marshalls too, right? You like that
Marshall. I like your Marshall. I haven't used them that much, but the times that I have, when they're good ones like this, I think like Voxes and like a lot of amps, they vary, right?
They're sort of, I guess, yeah. I mean, that Marshall, when I bought it, it didn't sound like that. Scott Henderson had one just like it, and he told me to send it to Custom Audio Electronics. There's a guy named Martin. I don't think he's with them anymore, but that's some mod he did. Mm-hmm. And it came back a whole different amp, and it's like, it's so good I don't even like taking
so
it out of the house.
So they put the game thing in there.
They just put a master. Uh-huh. And I had somebody work on it up here because something happened with the fuse, and he goes, man, it's too hot. Like, why'd they put this hot tube in there? But to me, it doesn't sound... You know, I've used it on the TV thing, and I just plug straight into it. Sounds great.
Yeah. Well, you know what? Never let anybody tell you that you need to change your stuff when something is sounding good. Because I've had various experts tell me, oh, man, let me have your amp. I'll improve it to amps that I liked, and then I didn't like it as much.
Yeah, you know, which brings up a good point, man, like gear. Guitar players, I think late, like maybe the last 10 years, I don't know, I never used to really be into gear. And then I was for a little while when I was doing some recording sessions and things. But I think guitar players get overly obsessed with things. And somebody like you could pick up anything, you know, and it will sound like you, you know, and because it's so much in the hands, you know. And
well, you know what, Shane, you're the same way. And any of us that have been playing for a long time sound like ourselves, you know, and so the different things that we hear on different guitars are a lot smaller than we think they are because we're used to our sound. You know, it's like your own voice. You're used to it. Mm-hmm. And then you play like a Tele or a Strat or you play a 335 and you think, oh, they really sound different. Well, they sound different, but not that different. The main ingredient are your fingers and the way you play the guitar.
Mm-hmm. And I think your ear, maybe subliminally, you adjust, you make physical changes to things, tone,
I think,
or whatever.
Yeah, subliminally, we just start to change it so it sounds the same.
You know, and you can't blame people because there's so many things out there now. It's like,
there's so much cool stuff to use.
There's tons of cool stuff. I mean, it's unbelievable. And I was always, before I came up here to New York, I'd always go, wow, man, these New York guys, they use like one guitar and like
really
three pedals that they carry on a subway or something like that, you know, and out of necessity.
That's a New York thing because we don't have our car.
That's what I think it was. It was out of necessity, you know, they just play through anything and make it work, you know. In L.A., you go to a blues jam and somebody's got a pedal board like 3 feet long.
Wow.
Yeah, I'm just making shit up. But
riding around on the subway, it doesn't work.
Yeah, right.
Got to be self-contained.
But it forces you to be, sometimes limitations force you to get more, squeeze everything you can out of gear, you know. So
yeah, and you know, I am from the old school, even though I mean the guys that I listened to when I was really young, they all kind of just had one guitar.
Yeah,
even the rock guys, Jimi Hendrix just always played that kind of guitar. You probably went through many of them, and that's the way it was, certainly for the jazz guys.
Were you ever into Clapton at all, like Cream?
Yeah. Yeah, I like them.
That's great.
I heard
stuff,
them.
Man.
I heard them play live in New York. Yeah,
wow,
a couple times.
He used to play really loud.
It was something. I mean, that was, you know, that was in a way in the '60s. That was a mindset of rock and roll that seemed similar to jazz for me, like the way Cream would stretch out and play long and other groups did that too. So that then when I heard Miles and stuff, it wasn't quite so foreign to me.
Yeah, they were really, they were almost fusion-y. I mean,
yeah,
you know, Ginger Baker
fusion,
was definitely,
but it was a kind
yeah,
of
he was a pre-fusion, he was a jazz drummer for sure. I mean,
when he started,
there were fills every other, you know, Mitch Mitchell too, there was a fill
absolutely.
Every other bar, there was some sort of jazz fill.
These guys played too much, right?
It sounded pretty good to me.
Yeah.
When you maybe we should talk about Miles a little bit. When you got that call, Mike Stern was on the gig, right? But you got the call to kind of come in and like sort of relief pitcher kind of call because Mike was in a bad space.
You know who really put together Miles' bands back then was Bill Evans, the sax player. Mm. When Miles came out of retirement, that was the first guy that he hooked up with. He met Bill, I think through Dave Lieben, and he said he really just thought Bill was the greatest because Bill played incredible saxophone and piano and everything. He was an incredible player, and Miles had him put together the bands. He put together the band with Mike Stern, and he got Marcus Miller on the gig. And then when Miles decided to have two guitars, Bill Evans got me the gig.
And was Miles pretty intimidating? He must have been at first, right?
Oh, for you God, to come in. Yeah. I played with him for 2.5 years, and the first year, I was so scared every time I was around him. You know, he was my idol, plus he was this intimidating character, you know?
Yeah. It must have been a learning experience to be around Miles.
It was great to, well, you know what? All the great jazz guys that I got to hang out with, from the beginning.
Chet Baker, that was even before Miles.
I got
Miles,
to play
right?
with Chet and Jerry Mulligan, and also a lot of sort of lesser-known guys in New York. But the whole bunch all together made for this great experience hanging out with the older generation. Steve Swallow, my buddy, is also from that generation, and I'd met him back before I ever met Miles or anybody. And he has been a mentor to me, and a lot of other guys too. I remember like the drummer with Miles, Al Foster. He was really a mentor and showed me a lot of stuff. And the list goes on and on. But to be around Miles was incredible because he was the. In 1982, when I joined his band, you know, there was a big thing about Miles coming back. He was the biggest name in jazz, and from an artistic point of view, not from, you know, I mean, it wasn't like there was no Kenny G. Jazz was jazz, you know, and Miles was the man, the great innovator, you know.
Yeah, it sounds like a great time, man. I mean,
and it was
I missed
fun
out on all that stuff.
Well, every generation, you're thinking, oh, I missed out on that, right? I'm thinking, oh, I missed out on Charlie Parker and Coltrane and stuff. So we all missed out on the stuff we love.
Yeah. Because
when we learn to play, we're listening to this stuff that's from 10 years before. because that's the best stuff around, right? I mean, I guess there are some people that are just in the moment, only listened and learned from the music that's happening right around them. And I envy them.
Yeah.
Because they can be right in it, you know?
I remember when I was at GIT, you came and did it was a concert kind of clinic, and uh-huh. Alan Holdsworth was sitting there.
He was
watching
there?
You. Yeah, wow. He came in just to watch your gig, you know, which
Man,
I thought was pretty...
You know, Alan has always been really nice to me, and all the great guitar players that I know, you know, that are sort of from my generation, like Alan and Pat Metheny and Bill Frisell and John Abercrombie and meeting John McLaughlin, you know, and all these guys, and Jim Hall, the older
Pat Martino.
Those they've all been really nice. Alan, I remember when Tony Williams had his fusion band, I was in Billy Cobham's fusion band, and they brought Alan in from England, you know, to play. And so I met Alan way back then.
That, the Billy Cobham band, George Duke Live, I used to have that record. I don't know if I'm playing this right. What was this?
That's it. Yeah, that's my little tune.
That's your tune, right?
Yeah.
What was that called?
Ivory Tattoo.
Ivory Tattoo. I don't remember what key it was in.
I don't even know either.
That's such a great riff, man.
I don't know where I got that from. But that was a great thing for me to get to play with Billy and George. People remember that band. That was before Miles or any of that. That was really my big break.
Were you doing your own solo stuff
well,
before
I was
then?
Doing, yeah, I was doing stuff. No, before I met Billy Cobham, I wasn't doing anything. I met him in 1975, January of 75. I joined his band and moved to New York all at the same time.
Oh, wow.
So I didn't do it. I was nothing before. I mean, I'd gotten to play a little with Jerry Mulligan.
Yeah.
But other than that, Billy Cobham discovered me. And I got to play in his band. For the first year, it was in the beginning, it was with the Brecker Brothers were in the band. And that blew my mind because wow. I was a huge fan of theirs. And then some other horn players, Larry Snyder and Walt Fowler, came in. He kept the horn band going, but then later, for over a year, we had the George Duke Billy Cobham band with Alfonso Johnson on mm-hmm. bass. And, you know, so this was great, man. I mean, we got to tour all over the place in Europe and America.
Frankenstein Goes to the Disco, that was one
yeah,
of the...
That was one of the tunes.
Yeah.
George is incredible stuff, and he was a great friend and a real mentor to me. And
what a great player.
Talk
man.
About
Amazing.
Some soul. Wow.
Yeah. Yeah.
And a lot of people don't know, he told me... I had heard him with Cannonball before that, because he played in Cannonball wow. Adderley's band, and then he joined Zappa. But I had heard him a lot, and then he once told me that the way he played the Moog, you know, he was famous for that, playing the blues, that he was originally trying to imitate Yusef Lateef.
Wow.
Yusef Lateef on oboe.
Wow.
Because Yusef played like blues oboe. Nobody else that I've heard has done that. And George thought of that when he was playing the Moog, you know.
Yusef Lateef, what is that record, Live at Pips?
Yeah, Live at Pips.
With James
from,
Black.
From New Orleans,
yeah. That's a pretty out there record, man.
It was beautiful.
I was listening to Buddy Rich the other day. Sheila had never heard Buddy Rich, so we were listening to you.
Oh, the tape?
Yeah, motherfuckers are sucking all over to it.
She was probably like, awesome.
She loved it, yeah.
She loved it. Yeah. But you know what's a drag, man? Everybody knows about Buddy Rich because of that.
Well, he was an amazing drummer, though, man.
Yeah, I mean, I met, there's this old guy up here who used to play with him. And he was saying, oh, yeah, everybody, all the young musicians know about is that tape, yeah. You know?
You know, a lot of your stuff, man, a lot of your grooves and things, especially Medeski, Martin Wood, and some of the things with Bill Stewart, too, they seem like really a lot of second line influences, a lot of New Orleans kind of stuff. Yeah. And then you had Johnny V in your band at some point. I mean, yeah. Did you ever, you listen to a lot of New Orleans music?
Well, absolutely. And what I tell people is, you know, the very first stuff I fell in love with as a kid, it turned out was New Orleans music, was, you know, early jazz. I remember hearing Louis Armstrong, you know, and I loving the rhythm mm-hmm. that those guys made. And then the early rock and roll stuff I loved, so much of it was recorded in New Orleans and the R&B, you know. And I didn't even know that there was this New Orleans connection until later on. And, of course, I love the Meters. When they first came out, I didn't even know they were from New Orleans. And so the R&B, and I remember when you look back at a lot of the R&B, the greatest tracks, you know, came out of New Orleans, which I didn't even know that, you know, Chris Kenner and Lee Dorsey.
Yeah.
And these old R&B things that I really liked. And then later in kind of the 70s, I started to realize where it came from and became a fan of the Wild Chapatoulas record,
you
know,
and
all that stuff, and really started to study it, and would go down to New Orleans some. And I remember there was a guy who had who brought jazz musicians down, Jonathan Rose, and he brought me down to play at Tyler's Beer Garden, just with me and Johnny Vodakovich and Jim Singleton.
Wow.
And that's when it really, really hit me, the way Johnny played and stuff, that man. There were people that played in that style that could use it in a jazz idiom, you know.
And what were you guys playing on those gigs?
Just standards.
Were you playing your own
stuff,
tunes?
But I remember, no, yeah, I don't think so. I was just jamming. But I remember we would do Freedom Jazz Dance, and he would play a second line on it, you know. And so we were doing these kind of, you know, jazz funk tunes, but he would put a second line on it.
Yeah.
And that was quite a revelation to me, you know. But by then I had already had things of the Mardi Gras Indians and stuff, and said, oh, wow, this is great. I was always aware of New Orleans because my mother was from New Orleans,
right.
And I had family down there that were by no means music people, you know, but I was aware of this music. And people should not ever discount for a second the fact that jazz came from New Orleans. And I'm talking about the early jazz, you know, Jelly Roll Morton and Louis Armstrong and this music, that rhythm is what...
Sidney Bechet.
Yeah, and all that stuff. And that rhythm from the city that came from 100-something years ago is the root of all of the stuff we know as New Orleans music, you know? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that whole Poinciana groove and that whole thing.
That's a New Orleans drummer and
Vernell Fournier, the first cat,
yeah.
Right? Yeah, I love all that stuff too, man. I remember hearing that your version of Sissy Strut when, you know, years ago, and I liked the way you modulated, because everybody does it the same way.
Yeah, I don't know.
Well, the way you...
I was sort of, you know, we were just trying
think
to think of something.
A flat,
we went to A flat.
Or something. It was cool.
Jazz guy, you know.
No, it was great, man.
seemed weird to record that at the time, you know, because it was sort of before the new interest in the meters, you know,
yeah.
the 90s interest in the meters.
Right.
And it was just a tune that we could play. As soon as the Sissy Strut came out, it was a hit on the radio, and every bar band played it in whatever year that was.
It became like Mustang Sally.
It was just like Mustang Sally or Midnight Hour. It was one of the tunes that everybody played on pickup gigs.
But, you know, everybody plays it wrong. I mean,
I think we all play it wrong.
Not your version. You did a completely cool thing. But, like, I've played it with Porter and these guys, you know, George Porter a million times, or any of these the guys in New Orleans. They're so picky about it. Because the B section, you know, most people go... Right? That's what most people do.
Right? What is it?
It's... Right? I mean, it's so...
one note different.
It's
okay,
one
note
different, but George will stop the band.
Well,
like, whoa, no, you're playing it wrong. You know, you're playing it...
I know. Well, that's their incredible repertoire, you know.
Yeah.
And
I think Leo plays it...
That's the way that sounds like the original.
I think that's he plays it down there.
I played wrong notes and everything. I
love that version.
You know what?
Man.
I don't care. I kind of like when people just do it their way.
I know.
Everything.
Why does it
on
have
everything.
To be? Yeah.
Yeah. You know, because it's not written in
You've
stone.
You've already recorded it. The meters have already. Here it is.
Yeah. Yeah. And their version that you can only be them. Yeah. Right.
Well. Man, I think we got a lot of good stuff. Yeah.
Hey, Shane, it's so great to hang with you and hear you play the guitar, because there's some incredible stuff coming out of that instrument. And
thank you.
And that groove is happening.
You don't have to say that, man. Come on.
Yeah, it's the truth. I don't have to. So, you know. Riff raff, riff raff,
riff raff. All right, there you go, everybody. If you're still listening, thank you. Thank you, John Schofield. And I'd also like to say thank you to my friends at True Fire, Allie and Brad, for their support and also great ideas and feedback launching this podcast. And also to my friend Jack Mealy down at Music Shed Studios in New Orleans, Louisiana, for helping out on some of the editing. Thank you, Jack. And thank you, everyone out there, for listening. See you next time. Today's intro and closing music is Trashy from my solo record, Highway 90. Check it out if you want to hear more. Thanks.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. They focus on exceeding your expectations and simplifying your life. Corient has been helping high achievers just like you enjoy their lives more fully, preserve their wealth, and provide for the people, causes, and communities they care about. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has deeply experienced teams in 23 strategic locations. Corient has extensive knowledge spanning the full spectrum of plan investing, lending, and money management disciplines. Leverage Corient's exclusive network of experts to craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex they may be. Real wealth requires real solutions. For more information, connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com. Corient.com.